Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy! They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine and More.
Blog Talk Radio.
Contra Radio Network. Preparedness Radio. With your host, John Jeffers.
And good evening. It's Sunday evening. Welcome to Contra Radio Network. I'm John Jeffers, your host. First things first, got to apologize for last night. I could not get in to help out Julie during our show. The ladies of the watch, for those of you that did tune in, I understand it was a little bit rocky, but a lot of the people did like it. I got hit with the malware attack from hell. I was up until, let's see, I tried getting in at 7:30, and I cleaned up. Finally got it cleaned up by 12:30 a.m. Anyways, so there. I see Guest 1774 has logged into the chat room. Welcome. Look, it's not going to be a long show tonight, but I want to talk about these things. This is 10 things that can go wrong in a get-home scenario. This is from SurvivalSullivan.com. This is interesting, and I think it's interesting to me because, one, I don't have to work anymore. I'm retired. However, there are others that, you know, well, still have to work. So this is for you people who still have to work. One of the basic things that many preppers carry is it's called a GHB or a get-home bag. GHB is not the date rape drug you want to carry with you. It stands for get-home bag. The GHB is designed to be within your reach at all times and carries those emergency supplies you might need if you are at work or otherwise away from home when a natural disaster or a critical event occurs. Now, the main purpose of the GHB is to carry supplies that will help you get home, to ensure they're able to get home, where hopefully you can meet up with other family members and make the decision to either bug in or bug out. A get-home bag is not just used during a critical event. It could also come in handy for any number of daily inconveniences, such as a flat tire, dead battery, construction detour, or another unexpected incident on the way home from work or another location. So the goal of a get-home bag in routine situations is to remain as comfortable as possible by preventing blisters, heat stroke, dehydration, sunburn, hypothermia, etc., you know, so you can make it home. But a primary reason for a GHB is to help you get home following a natural disaster or a critical event. So let's say you're at the office, which is 50 miles from home. You've got your EDC on your person, EDC, everyday carry, on your person, and you've got your GHB hanging on the back of your office door. The power in the building goes out suddenly and stays off. People around you are curious. They're calling friends and family members on their cell trying to find out what's going on. Now, we all know what happens when, you know, it's a power outage or minor inconvenience. It's, you know, your cell phone's usually worthless. Sometimes, you know, the text will still work. That's going to be your best bet anyways. Trying to call someone's not going to happen anyways. Let's get back to it. Suddenly, someone yells out, "It's war, martial law, we got to go home," whatever. So within minutes, your office erupts into chaos. You glance out the window and see coworkers exiting the building in droves. It's a human tsunami. You grab your cell and send a text to your wife that you're on your way home and what route you intend to use to get home. Then you grab your GHB from the hook on the door, change into your sturdy shoes and ditch your dress shoes because you're, you know, in the office, and head out of the building. Home is about a 20-minute drive in good traffic. It's just over 20 miles away. Even with some traffic delays, you should be home within an hour or so. But what if things don't go as planned? So we were going to discuss 10 things that can go wrong during a get-home scenario. In each discussion, we'll give a brief suggestion on how to prevent or resolve the issues so you can keep moving. Number one on the list, traffic jams. The first thing that could go wrong in a get-home scenario is that most likely and that is the roads can be jammed with traffic. Think about your typical rush hour traffic jams that occur at the start and, you know, at end of each working day, you know, rush hour, when most people are on the roads and heading to or from work. Now, traffic jams during a critical scenario will be 5 to 10 times worse. Not only will you be dealing with lots of traffic on the roads, but there will likely be abandoned cars that broke down, run out of gas, etc., and they're blocking the road. So make sure your GHB and your car, Bob, acronym for bug out bag, contains some food and water. Drive a different route to and from work during normal days so you can gauge the type of traffic, density of houses, possible water sources, etc. Carry a map with notes of these things for each route in your GHB or car. Carry extra cans of fuel on the back of your vehicle or in your cargo area if you can. Number two, let's say you run out of gas. The second thing that can occur during a get-home situation is your vehicle can run out of gas. Even if you've been diligent about not letting your gas tank get below the quarter or half tank mark on any given day, you will use extra gas during a traffic jam that lasts several hours. Or if your primary route is blocked and you have to take a longer alternative route, running out of gas could be an issue. There is the possibility that due to either debris on the road or even gunfire, your gas tank could be punctured and start leaking. So include a gas tank sealer, some distilled vinegar, and sponge in your bob, your car bob, so you can pull off and make the repairs as needed. Refill with your extra gas from the back if needed. How about this one? Number three, this happens. Car mechanical breakdown. Third most likely thing to happen during a get-home situation is that something will go wrong in your vehicle, causing it to break down. Could be anything from just windshield wipers that quit working to a flat tire, cracked radiator hose, or worse, a gunshot hole in your gas tank. Basically, anything that can break or stop working on your vehicle that would cause it to stop, you know, moving forward can be a problem. So commit to keeping your car's mechanical engine well-maintained and replace parts that are worn before they reach their, you know, breaking point. Make sure that your car bob includes tools and minor replacement parts such as wiper blades, brake pads, spare tire, spare brake lines, so you can make any necessary mechanical repairs. Okay, time out. Let me stop here. Brake pads, I'm going to pull my car over and do a brake job? I don't think I would. Carry extra mechanical fluids such as washer fluid, transmission fluid, oil, power steering, brake fluid, etc. And be prepared to head out on your bicycle or on foot if something breaks that you cannot repair. Just think about it. You're trying to get home during a critical event. You're going to stop and do a brake job. It'll still be there when I get back. Maybe, maybe not. I don't care. You have one mission. Get home. Number four, car crash. One thing to be particularly aware of during a critical or natural disaster scenario are car crashes. With all the traffic on the roads at the same time and people operating in a state of anxiety, fear, and panic, the chances of an actual car crash are far greater than during a normal day's commute. Even if you do everything right, someone else could still hit you. So, what are the things you might be able to do? Well, take defensive driving class and practice defensive driving daily, but especially during a critical event. Remain calm while driving and take an alternative route to avoid the majority of traffic. Carry a trauma first aid kit as part of your bob, your car bob, so you can be prepared to treat any injuries because emergency services personnel will likely be overwhelmed and unavailable. Number five, how about injury from debris? All right. So depending on the type of, you know, scenario that you find yourself in, one of the things that could go wrong when you're trying to get home is an injury from falling debris. Tree, power line, you know, lands on your vehicle, whatever. It could be debris that is hurling through the air and hits your windshield, or it could be falling ash from a volcanic eruption, burning trees from a wildfire, really anything. So know the proper safety procedures from different types of natural disasters that may happen in your immediate area. Make sure your GHB and or car bob includes an emergency radio so you can stay alerted to driving conditions in surrounding areas. Avoid affected areas as much as possible, even if this means taking a longer route to get home. Number six, fake police. When a critical scenario has gone on for several hours or days, you may have to worry about, you know, fake police or authorities. This will be people attempting to take advantage of unsuspecting citizens by pretending to be an authority figure. They could order you to turn around, try to confiscate your vehicle, or take control over your supplies. So carefully observe your local police department and sheriff departments during routine operations, you know, parade, crowd control, that kind of thing, highway stops, or other local events. Make sure you know the details of the uniforms and badges so you can spot a fake uniform or badge. Now, you may respectfully ask police for their badge identification if you're stopped or given an order and you suspect the person is not actually an authority. When I worked the streets, I always carried my ID with me. Sheriff's office ID was in my pocket next to my driver's license, my debit card, some cash, all that stuff. All right. Anyways, it was, and I never took offense to somebody saying, can I see your ID? Sure. Here you go. Now you see my ID. Can I see yours? Thank you very much. I'll be back with you in a few minutes. Not a big deal. All right. In a critical scenario, keep your distance from anyone acting as an authority figure unless you actually are in dire need of their assistance. Now you have actual, number seven, actual police or military checkpoints. Depending on how severe the crisis is in your area, you could come across actual police or military checkpoints. Things could be especially tense, especially with all the issues today surrounding illegal immigrants and refugees. Always be prepared to show your photo ID and passport or birth certificate. Carry an emergency radio or other communications device that will keep you abreast of where checkpoints are and to avoid them if you anticipate an issue. Note to the people and citizens of the People's Democratic Republic of Illinois, when you go to renew your driver's license, it's going to be close to 2 weeks because they're going to the new federal identification form that includes a background check on all your stuff. Oh, yeah. I just got my little notice in the mail. And it's going to cost you, well, in Illinois, it was like, you know, $8 to $10 for a driver's license. Now it's $30. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Anyways, number eight, the route is blocked by debris. We talked about that. Some of the stuff in this article is like, really, I'm going to put all this. What if I drive a subcompact car? Am I going to carry a hand chainsaw or a Fat Max utility bar so I can make roads passable? Probably not. You know, maybe you want to, you know, utilize one of your several alternative driving routes to get home that you have mapped out in advance. Consider railroad tracks, power line access roads, etc., as a workaround. If there's no other option, make use of a bicycle or a scooter that you can continue moving forward. And try to carry as much of life-sustaining supplies from your car bob as you can carry. All right, how about number nine? Your vehicle is stolen or confiscated. So what happens if you come out to work, come out of work to the parking lot, only to find that your car has been stolen by a desperate individual trying to get home as well? What if you arrive at a police or military checkpoint only to be told that your vehicle is going to be confiscated because it is a needed resource for police and emergency personnel? I have yet, in 26 years after the sheriff's office, I never had to say that to anybody. I just haven't. A stolen vehicle is really leaves you no choice but to set out on foot, so be prepared to get home using only your everyday carry and your GHB supplies. Ask police or military personnel to keep some of your supplies before they take the vehicle and try to get as much as you can into your car, into your pockets or GHB. Number 10, here's one. A mugger demands all of your supplies. So let's, as in the previous example, someone steals or confiscates your vehicle. You're on foot trying to make it home in a critical event. Co-workers or neighbors are going to be panicked. Majority of people will be scared. They'll be desperate and trying to get what they need to survive because they didn't plan for something like this. It's very likely that someone or a group of people will attempt to mug you or take your supplies. Let me, I got to disagree with this a bit. Not a lot, but a bit. And that is this. The majority of people will be scared. Most of them won't be desperate until they're 2 or 3 days into this crisis scenario that they realize that, I don't have water stored away. I don't have food. I'm out of food. I'm out of water, whatever. all right, before they try to come out and try to jack somebody and jack their supplies. So what you need to do is this. Buy a GHB that is nondescript and blends in, you know, such as your laptop bag or lightweight student backpack. Do not use a military backpack or an Alice pack or a camouflage backpack as your GHB, all right? Carry both lethal and non-lethal weapons, such as a handgun, that's your EDC, pepper spray, a knife, etc. You need to get training in physical self-defense, and you need to practice frequently, all right? That's just, you know, if you're, and you also might want to consider your physical well-being. Are you even able to walk 20 miles? Oh, so maintain your level of physical fitness so you can run if it'll help you keep your supplies, and apply the 2-is-1 and 1-is-none rule of survival so that your pack is taken, you will still have what you need to survive as part of your EDC. So what you're saying is maybe you might lose some, you might not. So, 10 scenarios, just some of the things that you can go wrong during a get-home scenario following a critical event. The idea is to anticipate anything that could happen and try to be prepared to either prevent it or work around it. Your primary goal following a critical event or natural disaster is to get home in one piece so you can reunite with your family and either bug out or bug in depending on the situation. The more you think about what could possibly go awry, the more flexible you'll be when you are actually thrown into a get-home scenario. Yes? Good tips, bad tips? Okay. Doesn't matter. Oh, what do we got here? All right. You know, we talk about prepper leaders and leadership and patriot groups and patriot leadership, and we've talked about a lot. In fact, we talked about just last week. We're going to talk about it a little bit here. You know, you've heard me use the term voluntary compliance. If you're not familiar with it, the concept is this. Being a prepper group leader or a patriot leader, group leader, you really don't have any legal authority to make people obey your orders. You just don't. Let's be honest about it. You don't. I don't. You don't. There's just nothing out there that says they have to obey you. What you're relying on, instead of the coercion of law to make them follow your orders, is you are relying on what's called voluntary compliance. And voluntary compliance is very simply, the people in your group have voluntarily subjected themselves to your orders and your leadership. Voluntarily complying, you know, we'll do as you ask, we'll follow you, do, you know, that kind of thing. Too many times, and this happens a lot in patriot groups, and it happens a lot in prepper groups. You get the one leader and his little cabal, his, you know, his best friend, his brother, you know, his best friend's uncle, and his, you know, your leader's brother, and all that stuff. And they form their own little cadre and look on the outside that, guess what? All of, you know, the rest of you will serve us and, you know, to attend to our needs and whatnot. And there are also times where you have leaders who are just draconian, who think that they have a legitimate legal right to force compliance with their orders within the prepper or patriot organization. It's just not true. Bottom line is this. No matter what you say or do, people can just say, screw you, I'm not going to do this, I'm not following you, I'm not going to go left, I'm going to go right, and good luck to you. All right, that, what are you going to do? Shoot them? Really? No. If you do that, then I really have to question your leadership abilities. Okay. This is from prepperswill.com, prepperswill.com. I think you'll find it interesting. And they wrote it on July 21st. It's by Bob Rogers. I thought it was pretty interesting, and I wanted to share it with you, especially with your leadership position. And, you know, becoming a leader during a crisis when others panic. People will panic. Most often because they are ill-prepared to deal with a situation that may be escalating. The reality of the situation is more than they can handle because no mental or physical preparations were ever made. In those challenging times, people will look for a leader, for someone to tell them what to do and get them to safety. In order to become a leader, you must be mentally and physically prepared to react to a disaster regardless of its nature. There are four psychological stages that one should master to deal with the crisis. Now, these four stages are observe, orient, decide, and act. If you've heard these before, then you know I'm talking about something called the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act. OODA. O-O-D-A. The OODA loop. The first one is observe. You have to process the totality of what is occurring. Not the particulars. You should avoid losing yourself to details and just concentrate on the life-threatening elements. For example, you do not need to know why there is a shooter in the building, just that there is one, and it's threatening your life and the ones of the people around you. The second is orient. A leader should be able to pinpoint where the source of the life-threatening event is coming from and where you are in relation to it. In any major disaster, there will be a lot of confusion, and various elements will be changing around you. It's going to be very fluid, very dynamic. In order to get a grip on reality, you'll have to reorient yourself to your surroundings. The third step is decide. Now, this step involves creating a plan relative to your brief orientation and observations. As a leader, you don't have to make a perfect plan, but you must come up with something quickly because time is of the essence. So in order to master this step and facilitate the decision you need to take, you should have enough emergency preparedness knowledge and experience with advanced planning. Okay? How many people have actually had a critical event experience? I mean, actually had one or part of that experience actually had a critical event? Very few people. Now, the fourth is called ACT. Observe, orient, decide, and this is going to be ACT. Now, regardless of the qualities of the plan you have created, you as a leader must act upon it immediately. Now, during an emergency situation, inaction and doubt are the greatest obstacles. As a leader, it will be your ability to act that will make or break your survival efforts. Rounding up the people to follow you is certainly no easy task, and each type of disaster creates various elements of society that you will have to act upon. There will be those who will enter a state of panic, and you have two choices when dealing with them. You can try to calm them, or you can avoid them. Trying to calm panicking people by speaking in a relaxed, soothing, and gentle tone. You should assure them that they will be okay and that everything is all right. Some psychoanalysts suggest empowering those that are frightened by explaining that you need their help and that you need them to be calm in order for the group to survive. Give them a goal-oriented task to occupy their mind. When included into a plan, the panicked will generally, not always, will generally pull together their emotions quite quickly. Another alternative would be, to leave them behind. And although it may sound inhumane, this is a step needed in order to assure the survival of the group. So people who feel panic or desperation often begin to function solely on instincts and almost often revert back to a flight or freeze response. No, I think they misspelled that. It should revert back to a fight. Well, it could be flight or freeze. Always referred to as fight or flight. This could put the group into danger, and their inability to function will slow you down or worse. They can also turn on you as they end up seeing everyone as a potential danger when they go through a psychotic break, and it could happen. So you have to accept the reality of the situation and effortlessly develop a split-second solution to it. Survival will not be possible if you allow someone else's expression of panic or fear to spread. As a leader, it is your duty to take ownership of the situation and create a solution, even if it means expelling certain members from the group. Case in point, remember the old movie, The Poseidon Adventure, back in the 1970s? You had those two groups. Gene Hackman was leading the group through the engine room, and what was his name? Albert Finney. Was it Albert Finney? Was leading another group to the bow of the Poseidon. And Hackman pled with them, you know, don't go there. The bow's underwater. We're upside down. The bow's underwater. You're going to die. And the majority of the people chose, no, we're going to the bow where the captain is. And Hackman said, okay, you go your way, I'll go mine. You know, God love you. And off they went. Same situation. Kind of. So, a leader should have a formed mindset, survival skills, and confidence to put those skills to good use. In order to focus your mind, you will need to organize the people around you and assign tasks that will give them a functioning role in your creative survival solution. This will also give the opportunity to think more clearly and act in a decisive manner when the time calls for it. All right. So become the leader people need when things go south. One, assess the situation. You should clearly understand the problem and how to fix it. You must develop a plan in order to survive. Always remember the four psychological stages: observe, orient, decide, and act. OODA, the OODA loop. Because once you do those four steps, next phase, you do the same thing again. As you are moving from place to place, you are in the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, and act. What do I see? All right, I see that street doesn't look safe. I see too many ambush points. I don't like it. Orient. Okay, I can't go down that road. I'm going to go down this alley and cut back on that road. Decide. When are we going to do it? Now. Same thing with the act. Now. So you've looked around. You've seen what the terrain looks like. I could go here and here and here. I don't want to go there. Decide which route you want to take. You do it. Done. And as you move along to the next waypoint, you're back in the OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act. Everybody gets that. All right. Get everyone's attention. Be loud and command respect from the group. Make it apparent that you are in charge. An effective leader will do this without hesitation and without confrontation. In a disaster, most people will be looking for someone to tell them what to do. Simply adopt the role if you know what you're doing. And remember, there are other people out there who think they know what they're doing. Number three, be ready to calm any fear or panic. Start by letting everyone know that things are under control and that everything will be okay. You should be able to make them feel safe and at ease with you in charge, even though the reality may be completely different. A good leader should offer words of encouragement. Every victory starts with a group pep talk. Start by letting them know that they are valued and needed, and that with their help, this danger can be overcome. Tell your survival group how strong they are. Share your solution to the crisis. Even if your plan is not perfect, you should tell everyone about it and why it is going to work. Speak clearly. Don't hesitate. Be specific in order to put everyone at ease. Be sure to delegate tasks. A leader should get everyone involved in the plan, as no task is too small for the given situation. Allow for input and suggestions, but do not deviate from the original plan. If you do not let people speak their mind, you'll be seen more as a dictator rather than a leader. However, changing the plan unnecessarily based on popular suggestions can lead to confusion and destroy morale and get other people killed. Number seven, leader of the pack, you must act on and supervise your plan. Remember that you're the leader and you will be put to the test. Many people will readily speak ill of something after it is enacted because they feel they need to make a stand and speak up, even if it's not constructive. However, those same people will be unable to come up with a new plan. Do not allow negative comments or opinions to enter the group space and be ready to act. you should suppress any dissent that would interfere with the highest interest of the group, which is what? Survival. Now, thinking outside the box, a strong point of a good leader. The responsive prepper is all too aware of the available resources that can be found in a certain environment, and he or she can make good use of those resources. The ability to improvise, come up with solutions when all odds are against you is what separates a real leader from a pretend one. Even law enforcement and first responders often use solutions that are not listed in training manuals, and these improvised tactics save lives. Your ability to survive will largely be attributed to your quick and decisive action, but also to the ways you're able to improvise and find solutions that may seem impossible for the average Joe. As you've adopted a leadership role, you must be able and willing to act when necessary, even if sometimes you have to rely on an unusual solution or tactic. Preppers may be seen as odd individuals by most members of society, but they possess tremendous leadership traits. They have the knowledge and skills to survive. And some of them have military background that will help lead people to safety when a crisis becomes critical. So what do you think? Do you agree with what we've been talking about? Well, something else we want to talk about is this. This is for a green sale. Mitch in Texas. Terry in Missouri. Julie in the Cascadian Mountains. Brandon in Washington. He's usually an over-the-road truck driver. The Rhode Island Warlord. They've asked this question, so I want to talk about it. At one point in now, they've all asked this question, and I want to be able to answer it for them. And for my friend America, I know you're upset about last night. It's all right, my friend. I have not abandoned you. Nor will I. All right. Foil hat soldier, thank you goes out for the information you passed along to me this morning about last night. I do appreciate it. Okay. How to form a survival group. Where did I find this? PreppersWorld.com again. All right, that'll work. October 20th, 2015 by Bob Rogers. I think this is important information because many times I get the question, I'm trying to form a group. How do I do it? How do I do it? I've got some suggestions, but here's another way. You know, we live in an uncertain world with each passing day. More and more people decide to become survivalists and preppers. Unfortunately, the path that most of these people chose is the path of the lone wolf. Although many aspects of preparedness tend to focus on the individual, history has shown us that a united force is stronger. It has more chances of survival than a single individual. Forming a survival group should be taken into consideration by all preppers, and the following suggestions will help get you started. Humans made it so far because we are social beings and we often depend on networks of people to get things done. It doesn't matter if you're at work or at home. A good network of people can make your life easier. It will provide you with emotional support and it gives you a sense of security. In a critical event, a survival group would make a whole lot of sense because you're building an alliance that will help you survive and thrive when things go south. Now, some say that forming a survival group is hard and it takes a lot of work. But that is just a matter of perspective. Now, I admit that may be true for some, especially for those from large communities, where people will look at you, you know, funny just for saying you are a prepper. The larger the community, the harder it will be to form a trustworthy group. That doesn't mean you don't have to try and do your best to raise awareness about an emergency situation or a critical event. In today's modern world, social isolation is your worst enemy when it comes to forming a survival group. We are hooked into the digital network, and we have thousands of friends when disaster strikes, and you have to put your faith in real people. All right. However, if you're part of a smaller community, one that is not fond of, you know, city folks, you have a better chance of getting your survival group. Smaller communities have a bond that was perpetuated for centuries, and the members of such communities care for each other. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you should move out of the city, although it might be a good idea. I just want to let you know what your chances of forming a survival group are based on your social environment. So how do you get your own survival group? Well, you got to reach out to people. Now, right now, some of you are going, OPSEC, OPSEC, OPSEC. First rule of prepper group is you don't talk about prepper group. Really? Then how am I supposed to let people know I'm trying to form a group? Yeah, I thought so. Now sit down, shut up, and listen. You got to reach out to people. You can't form a survival group without letting people know about your intentions. I mean, they can't. They're not mind readers. They don't know. If they don't know about it, they can't act on it. So reach out to people. It can be difficult for some, while others is just like making another sale at the office. If you live in a big city, it may be harder to form a survival group. And the first thing you have to do is to reach out to friends and people you know best. Once you have a few friends that are interested in your group, you can establish meetings to discuss more about the subject. You can also join social media groups from your area that are interested in preparedness and survival. Go to the meetings. I know you got to go to meetings. How are you supposed to know these people if you don't go to meetings? Know people and let them know about your survival group if you find them trustworthy. However, if you're part of a smaller community, even a barbecue can be a good occasion to start discussing about forming a survival group. Now invite some friends and neighbors over to enjoy a good steak and a cold beer and bring up the subject when you get the occasion. Don't make a big announcement and don't be ecstatic, but rather bring up the subject with nonchalance. For those that don't know what that means, just bring it up and be real cool about it. That's all. You can see how things go on from there, and by the end of the day, you'll form an opinion on whom to contact in the coming weeks. Now, a survival group means safety first. Safety in numbers is a tactic mankind has used since the Stone Age, and it works. A group of people offers more protection than an individual ever could, and it provides a sense of security to each member that is part of your survival group. Now, I know there are some people out there, and you've heard of a talk, and so have I, who think that they're like the ultimate sniper, and they're going to take down 150 people, and da-da-da-da-da, and they're going to be the lone wolf, and they're going to come take your supplies, yada-yada-yada. Okay, great. Let me know how that lone wolf thing works out for you, because it won't. So, in any survival situation, there are many dangers that simply cannot be handled by a single person. During civil unrest, the unprepared will go after your supplies and be part of a survival group will make sure your supplies are protected. People can take turns sleeping and keeping watch. If you are injured or sick, you cannot provide food or security, and having backup is important. The same goes for defending your community. The more firepower you have, the better your chances of survival. Remember, peace through superior firepower. This is the main argument that you should bring up when discussing with people about forming a survival group. If they understand what safety in numbers means for their future, they will join your alliance. Now, spreading the work is easier if you have a survival group. Have a group of people working together during a crisis will greatly enhance what gets done, and it will increase your chances of survival. You can't know it all, and most certainly you can't do it all. Much easier to get things done when you have the proper help, and it is crucial to have the right skill set for certain survival chores. A survival group will allow each individual to focus on what he or she does best. Just look at the primitive skills alone. How many of you would love to have your own survival group? You know, the guy building tools and shelters from scratch using wood and mud, you know, the one of those amazing YouTube videos. A group of people working together will be more efficient because there will be those who, you know, specialize on certain skills, and you can get a whole lot more done in less time with a group. Remember the old Chinese proverb, many hands make light the work. So, you can get a whole lot more done and less time with the group. So in a survival situation, time is of the essence, and a lone wolf can't do everything right under pressure. Let people know about the strengths of your group and how it can help them in an uncertain future. A survival group will maximize your resources. A survival group can bring more resources to the table than an individual. This means that water, food, fuel, and tools can be used for the survival of the entire group. Some may stockpile extra fuel. Others may hoard tools due to their, antique value. And there are those who stockpile food to feed an entire neighborhood. If you put all the resources together and you assure a correct distribution for each member of the survival group, you'll have less to, you'll have to worry less about the future. Not to mention that a survival group provides a resource that increases significantly with each member, which is knowledge. My grandfather used to say that it's easy to teach someone how to fire a weapon or build a chicken coop, but you can never copy the skill sets underlined by the lifetime of training. Since humans are the most important resources for every survival group, having people in your group, like a doctor, a nurse, a mechanic, a welder, and so on, will increase the value of life for the entire alliance. Remember that when you talk with people about resources, you have to be as vague as possible, and your main point of focus should not be the items. So don't brag about your resources. You should put emphasis on the human resources you have and how they can keep the group safe. Let's see who's calling. Welcome to CRN.
Good morning this evening.
How are you, sir?
Well, I woke up and saw daylight and made everything else easier.
Well, being on this side of the grass does help.
I'll give you a lot more options, I guarantee.
Oh, yes. Well, so, were you listening to Julie's show last night?
I caught about 20, 30 minutes of it.
Yeah, I heard it was pretty rocky. But it happens.
We'll say that it got kind of warm in the clubhouse until we figured out how to find the ignore button and turn the temperature down.
Oh, there you go.
It was... Listen to the conversation. It was epic.
Imagine.
It was. Aside from the chat room, the conversation itself though was really. John, it was hard to listen to.
What do you mean?
It was. What's the word I'm looking for? It was uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
They were discussing a lot of things about if you're dealing with. Special needs children, or the elderly and the infirm, and people like that, and just some of the things that the decisions would probably be faced with, and truer words were never spoken, and it really kind of put it in your face. It's like you have to think about this in a worst case scenario, and it's difficult. I was kind of surprised at how uncomfortable it made me to have to actually go down that road myself and really face some of that stuff. There's senior citizens in my world, and I think most of us have, seniors in around us, or, people with, compromised health or whatever, and we don't often talk about that.
We don't. And we need to.
We really don't. Yeah, I give Julie and Kim, I give them major, major props. I'll tell you what, that Ladies of the Watch have really got it going on.
They do.
They really have it going on.
That's why I chose Julie.
I'm telling you, what an asset.
It's interesting.
What a raging asset.
Thank you. It's interesting. It's called Ladies of the Watch, but there seems to be a lot of guys listening in on it, which just goes to prove prepping doesn't care about your gender. What it cares about is your ability and what you bring to the table. It's interesting that you brought that up because one of the questions I was going to bring up for the prepper leaders and patriot leaders is a scenario in which you're going to have to make a decision. Let's say for the good of the group, you have to move the group to a different locale, different location. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the group either A, and just, you have to move for whatever reason. It doesn't matter what the reason is. You got to move the group to a different location. And some of the group either cannot travel due to sickness, or maybe health issue, or they might, whatever the reason is, doesn't matter. Say some of the group cannot go. They can't move. They can't make it. They can't go. So you, as the leader, it makes, what decision are you going to make? Do I move the group as a whole, whether they can make it or not, and hope they make it? Do you just take the ones that you can take with you to the right place, to the other place, and leave those behind? I mean, it's a terrible, look, it's a shit sandwich, for the lack of better term.
Yeah.
It's a shit sandwich, and you're going to have to take a bite. Now, which side you take a bite on, well, that's up to you as the leader.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be or what about this? You get to the new location and you realize that, you know what? There's not enough room for everybody. Maybe it's a bunker somewhere and you're going to fit X amount of people in there. What do you do with the 30 extra people? I mean, what do you do with them? I mean, you say, sorry, you can't come in the bunker. I mean, like I said, it's a crappy scenario, but one that we have to think of. If you're going to be a leader, these are the situations and questions you're going to have to answer eventually, because it will happen.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad to see that Julie hit that spot with the ladies and Kim. I think I talked to Kim. We were talking to Kim last week. I was telling her, I said, hey, she didn't think she brought any value, quote unquote, value to the show. And I said, negative, you do if you're a single mom. I'm not a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the same perspective that you have. So tell me, what do you think? And it was interesting. And once she understood that, she was, much more accepting of it. But I'm glad
I'll
to see
you
that.
What, Kim,
tell me.
I was going to say, Kim is an interesting person. I've never met her. Don't even converse with her on the show or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell the passion and the intensity that it seems like she lives every breath with.
Oh, she's serious.
She is not messing around.
She's a serious prepper.
This lady, let's put it this way. I mean, some people may be intense, but they may not know what they're talking about, despite their best intentions. The stuff that she discusses and the way she discusses it, I have to believe that, she's been exposed to it. She's thought through, she's been with people who have something. I mean, there's just a layer of depth there that you don't get in a lot of people.
Right.
And I think most of it, guys like me need to just sit down, shut up, hang on, and
go for the ride.
Yeah. You just go and take notes.
Take notes, yes.
And I'm happy to say that there was a lot of the guys that I see in the chat room here showed up last night, and it was Julian and Kim talking. Everybody else was kind of listening, and I'm glad to see that, because I mean, there was some discussion on the chat, but I think, like I say, it was such an intense conversation last night, and it was the things that you don't want to talk about, is the things you don't want to think about, I should say. Not so much talking about it, but it's hard to talk about. It's really hard to think about. And if we're ever faced with actually having to make those decisions,
God have mercy on us.
It's kind of beyond life and death. It really is.
It's a
legacy. Yeah, those are legacy decisions. Okay.
Well, it's true. It's true. As true as it's going to be, because some won't survive. And
absolutely,
it's a crappy decision. I asked members of my group early on. I said, when you buy your prepping stuff, your supplies, are you just buying for yourself and your immediate family? And one of the answers was, well, yeah. I said, well, what about when your niece comes to your door? He goes, I'll take her right away. Then you better start prepping for her. What about your neighbors? What if your neighbors come over and say, look, we understand that, but can you take our kids? You know, that's two more mouths to feed. And those two more mouths mean that's less. You've run, you know, X amount of days. You might have had 14 days. Now you got down to 12 or whatever. And those are the situations that we have to think about as prepper leaders. You know, one of the ways we got around it was we would take new people into the group if they had a skill that we needed. I threw one thing out. I said, would you guys take a plumber in your group? They said, a plumber? I said, you know, the plumber, the water guy. Pipes, right. Drains, that kind of guy. Would you bring him in the group? And a lot of them, they said no. And I said, okay, why not? And they gave their reasons. And I said, but this is a guy who knows about water, water pumps, well pumps, pipes, how to irrigate it, put the pipes together. He knows what to look for. And I said, I would take the plumber and his wife and his kids because he has a skill. And, you know, says, well, what do you do about the defense? I said, what happened when you went to for defense? You had to go get your own weapon. You had to, you had to go a couple classes, learn how to shoot, and you had to practice. That could be done. It may not be pretty, but it could be done. So, and like you said,
and the thing too, when you're dealing with somebody like that, they bring a skill, and especially if they're, you know, a fairly advanced level of competency, that's a skill you can teach other people.
Exactly. And I do the same thing. What about a car mechanic? I said, yeah, I'll take a car mechanic anytime. So my point was, you know, when you're prepping, it's always important to prep for more than just your family.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, if you're in your area of operations and you're in your defensive mode and somebody comes along to your checkpoint, you're going to turn them away? What if this guy has, you know, some needed skills that may not, not be too obvious or apparent, but you're going to, you know, I say take the guy. It might be extra mouths to feed, but now you've got extra people to help with the workload. You got extra people.
Right.
Yeah, you might have to feed, but the skill level he has might offset that. So.
And the thing too, I mean, what happens when somebody comes along and they don't have, you know, if it's redundant, you know, what you've already got. You don't really need more people with that particular, or they don't really have any particular skills, you know.
I know.
On the other hand, this person might be, maybe they're genuine and they're willing to earn their way in.
Exactly.
You know, by some kind of, you know, hey, I'll chop wood and I'll, you know, carry the buckets of water or whatever the heck, you know, pick a chore.
Right.
I've come to believe, and I don't know if I'm right or not, but my gut feeling is that if you get somebody, I've always said skills can be taught.
Yeah.
You have to bring your own attitude and your own mindset.
Correct.
The attitude will always be more important than the immediate skill set. If you get somebody who just, you know, wants to be a boat anchor, who just wants wants somebody to feel sorry for them,
that's
not going to be helpful.
Here's a rule.
If you got somebody's like,
here's a rule of thumb, man. And I got this from the military. It doesn't matter what job you have in the military. Everybody goes through basic training and it becomes a basic rifleman. You can apply that to your prepper group. Like you said, you may have somebody who doesn't have a skill or it's a redundant skill or whatever. But you can teach that person how to shoot, how to do proper, how to do a watch, a guard duty. You can teach that person. For example, you know what? Would you take a school teacher let's say a middle school teacher. Would you take a teacher into your group?
Well, only in a hot second. There's leadership, baby.
There you go. You, sir, have passed the OODA loop. Congratulations. Yeah, you know, yeah. Now, does the teacher have technical skills? No. Are you going to have children with your prepper group? Chances are, if you don't, you're probably going to end up with some anyways. And if anything, you have to. Somebody has to teach them to read, how to do basic mathematics. You know, and that's the guy I'm not putting on guard duty, unless I have to. His job is to educate the young. And let's face it, as some adults, our math skills have dwindled quite a bit since we were in school.
Oh, you know, boy.
We got a skill.
Guilty as charged.
Join the club. But if you've got somebody who has a basic a degree in teaching, they're going to have that basic background that they need. And I think it's important to have a teacher, an educator.
There's it's like any other profession. I mean, there's good teachers and bad teachers, no greater or lesser. But still, if somebody who's actually educated to work in a classroom environment, or now, interesting enough, my wife is involved in education. Mm-hmm. She's worked everything from teacher's aide to assistant principal positions.
Right.
And it's funny. I mean, teaching comparatively can be such a small job, a small part of the job. There is so much more as far as, just classroom management. And you've got 20, 25 kids in the class.
Right.
And you talk about herding cats.
It's true.
Yeah, that's why I say that's where the leadership issues come in, and management issues, and keeping a whole bunch of plates spinning on a whole bunch of sticks is what it comes down to. So don't trip over some of these things without giving things due consideration.
And don't forget, it's not going to be a traditional classroom. It's not going to be a traditional school. You might, they might go to school for 3 hours a day. The rest of the time, they're helping out in the area of operations, doing the little tasks and all that, And so it's definitely going to be a prime learning environment for the children.
Oh, they will.
And you're not going to have disciplinary problems like you do in the classroom. It's just not going to happen.
The situation that gives us our disciplinary issues now, those situations will be gone.
Oh yes.
And the responses to them will be gone. And it's like, okay, that everything we know about the current day and age for in the classroom is going out the window.
Oh yeah.
It's going
and flushed
out
twice.
Yeah.
But we need that though, because parents are going to be hands on. There are very vocations we're going to talk that maybe your group is lacking, but the right person comes along and like I said, a leadership issue. Do we need this skill? Is this a redundant skill we already have? What can we do with this person? There's lots of stuff we can do with extra people. One of the articles I was talking about tonight, and he talked about, and that's great. Smaller communities have a tendency to care for each other more than, say, the large urban environments, and I believe that.
Yeah, I would say so.
So when you have your prepper group, you're just a subgroup of the community. Would you take a librarian? I'll take a librarian because there's going to be lots of libraries that have been abandoned. And library sciences will be able to show, at least assist in the education by showing them how to use. How many kids actually go to a library nowadays and actually check out a book or do their research papers? Most of them just do it on the computer at home.
Right.
I remember hearing 25 years ago that something like only 3% of any, you know, population cross section actually ever uses a library, and that was before we had the internet in any large measure.
I believe it.
So if it was 3%, you know, 20 years ago, imagine how much smaller it is now.
It is smaller, and yet, you know, we use, you know, libraries, you know, depend on the property taxes to support the base in the community. And you think about it, the library, your local library, is a true knowledge center that doesn't depend on electricity to use. If you can read, you can get a book. Can you read a map? They teach you how to read math because libraries have all kinds of different maps in there. You just got to know where to look for them, but they're there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, libraries are such an underrated treasure of information.
It is. I agree.
It's sickening when you think that we have that much, you know, that treasure available to us, and most people just don't
squander it.
They don't have. Yeah. Yeah,
because
just,
I'd rather sit on
there
Facebook.
So kids can, it's there so kids can do research on book reports or whatever for grade school and I don't know. It's too bad. Another one of those "it is what it is" moments.
It is.
Do not underestimate the library.
Do not. That's a valuable resource, and every community has one. And if you're in a large urban system, like, you know, Chicago Public Library. They've got satellite libraries all over the city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're living in any big city, I guarantee you, your library system is probably set up like Chicago's, and you got branch libraries all over the place.
Right.
So it's always a good go-to source for knowledge.
And even here in northeast Illinois, the northern suburbs where we're located, we've got some fabulous libraries around.
We really do.
This area has really invested highly in their libraries.
They have.
And I don't feel bad about paying taxes toward that, at least.
Nope.
Because we've got some beautiful facilities there, and I hope that it would be nice if people took better advantage of what's available to them. But
I see Chuck has logged into the chat room. We'll say hi to him, you know, but as you know, so that's what I want to talk about tonight was just the leadership aspects of being, whether you're in a patriot group, prepper group, or both. You're never, I wish there were, there are ways, and I'll do it later, but we're going to start. I think I'd like to start talking about how to be a leader. What
that would be,
you know,
really awesome.
I think because we have, I've heard recently, and I should say recently, a couple of years ago, McHenry had a great prepper group going, and leadership was forgetting that they didn't have any real authority to make these people follow his orders or his lead or whatever, and the group ended up actually breaking apart. So
that's a shame.
I think it is a shame because this guy was a combat vet, and you know, some of his guys came over to my prepper group. They said, "Do you mind if you join?" I said, "I don't mind." I said, "The whole point of my prepper group was to, you know, to develop mutual assistance groups all over the country."
Mm-hmm.
So you could call your group whatever you want. If you want to stay affiliated with the 11th APG, that's great. We know who we got where. That's fine. Run the group as you see fit. But bear in mind, you really don't have any really real authority to make these people do anything or force them to follow your orders or follow your lead. But I think what we need is, I'm going to look into it. Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. You know, I think Chuck would be good for this, I think. I'll have to get a hold of him later. I'll talk about it. But I think when leadership, you know, they call it leadership development courses, and the military is really big on it. Before, even if you get your promotion, you're not even considered a real say, for example, you're not a real sergeant, you go to, you know, basic leadership development course, and then you go to an advanced leadership development course. And what that does, it teaches you how to be a leader. And I think those are so, so important in developing, especially for the prepper groups, the patriot groups, you know. Thoughts? What do you guys think?
Majority of the prepper groups or the patriot groups are comprised of civilians, many of them with military experience, probably a good percentage of them without military experience, and basically they have an obsessive erection, if you will, for their civil liberties and freedom and so on and so forth, which is contrary to the overall command structure. So that there are some challenges there in trying to have the challenges of having good leadership, and expecting that those that are under you to basically comply, or to that seems to be the main conflict there, I would say. So, you know, a lot of groups will try to maintain a certain level of readiness in terms of provisions, in terms of, you know, I guess, standard ordnance, and so on and so forth. But whether or not the actual elements inside that group is able to comply or will comply, that's a totally whole different matter altogether. When you document something, that's one thing, but being able to enforce it or trying to execute it and with the hopes of everyone following it, that's pretty much a tough one.
It's a different animal, I agree. Chuck, what was your opinion of last night's show? The subject matter.
The subject matter, I think, was, you know what?
We're listening. Come on, Chuck, you there?
Yeah, but I'm about to reboot. Oh. Let me call back in, okay?
All right. Call back in.
All right.
I'll be here.
Sorry about that.
All right. He's gone for a while. I just want to get his opinion, too. Kevin, what do you think?
It seems to me, and I don't have military background or anything like that, so this is just, again, ramblings here. But the people that I've seen who are the most effective leaders were people who could – they'd win people's respect, you know, the trust. Those are things that you earn. It's not something that – oh, in certain situations, sure, you can require somebody's compliance or whatever, or even the respect in as much as, you know, if somebody can inflict a problem, you know, cause me trouble, then I will respect that. I'll give them that level of respect, but that's not the kind of respect we're talking about.
Right.
When you're in a situation that is you know, voluntary compliance, you have to be able to win people's respect and win their trust. And if you can do that and do so consistently, then people are much more willing to follow. And the thing about that in an environment like that has been my observation that it does become much more of a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll start having a meeting on minds and exchange of ideas, and okay, you may never be – nobody's ever going to be completely happy with anything. That's not the point. The point is that you wind up – you know, you just need to win more than you lose in a situation like this. And when people just want to walk in, like I think you said one of them – was it last week or maybe it's Wednesday night – be a lot of people that want to be generals and nobody wants to be a private. You know, if you're not willing to be a private, you're probably not qualified to be a general.
Well, as the military says, you have to learn to take orders before you give them. Yeah, that's
right.
And that's
right,
and that's a true maxim. That's a true maxim. So.
Yeah, I think that's
well, you know,
it's interesting to see how that shakes out. You know, I mean, a lot of times you get politics involved and people's, you know, they have their own personal agendas involved and things like that. And that's just human nature. And as soon as you have an organization of more than one person, you've got politics involved. But,
yep.
It's managed being able to control that in ourselves and hopefully encourage others to control that in themselves.
Difficult now. Hey, that's difficult now. Imagine what it's like in a critical event. You're going to get 12. Yeah. You're going to run into a road junction with five different roads. You're going to get five different opinions on which road to take.
Right.
I mean, that's why.
I heard. I worked for a guy one time. He said, yeah, you know what? Working here is like tying five horses together and smacking them all in the behind at once.
Yeah. You all want to go their different direction.
Right.
That's why I'm a big believer in make your outline plan. And the reason I say outline is because you got to leave the plan extremely dynamic, fluid, and flexible. Because not everything is going to work out
off
the way you think.
Right. It's almost a mistake, I believe, to make it too specific.
You can make some of the plans, like the communication plans. You can make those very specific. But as for operational plans, you got to leave them flexible because you're going to run into all kinds of nonsense, and it's going to happen.
No point in even trying to anticipate.
you're gonna
see everything, from lightning from the ground up to unicorns riding rainbows. So just let anything distract you.
Oh, it's nutty. I know, and you can see it happening. You know it does.
Some of the stories. You listen to old war stories and stuff from World War II or any war.
Read my mind.
All it is just chaos it's chaos that you expected. I think is the only way you can describe it. I mean, once the rocket's red glare shows up,
it's a whole new game. And I'll tell you that.
Can you imagine what it must have been like for, D-Day, the kind of chaos that just reigned?
It was insane. But, that's why when you have leadership that's on the ground, you can change it. I mean, let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you watch, Saving Private Ryan, people landing on the wrong beach, the wrong area, it's going to happen. But they got the flexibility with leadership on the ground that knows how to be a leader and get things going again. Plans are always good until the first bullet's fired. Then it all goes to hell.
Right.
But with that said, you read my mind. I was thinking, you're thinking, Normandy. I'm thinking the war between the states when you have very limited.
Oh, gosh, I can't even imagine.
You talk about chaos. It's like, go there and God be with you. you got your leaders trying to make it happen, but how many times have we read in the history books that plan didn't really work out that well or the objective suddenly switched? Which reminds me, I was in the military, they talked about, I heard the officers talking one day about a war game that was going on at Fort Ord in California. What they call it OPFOR, which is the red team. And all they did was they trained using Soviet battle doctrine because that was, I was a child of the Cold War. And the red team fought exclusively under the battle doctrine of the Soviet Union. And they were talking to one of the new officers who just transferred in. He says, I faced these guys last year. And he said, I'm up in arms going crazy. And then after the action's over and they come to, debrief the officers what was going on, it turns out the guy was 20 miles. He wasn't even at the point of axis of advance. He was off, 20 miles off to the flanks. He said, I thought I was in the axis of advance. But that just goes to show how quickly objectives can change, plans change, and it's just the chaos of it. And you do the best you can, obviously. But that's why I think PREPA groups have to start forming a really a good leadership cadre. We don't, and I don't, my cadre, I don't mean using your brother and his best friend as leadership. If they can't do it, you don't want them there. You know, if
right.
they're goofs about it, you know.
Yeah,
so,
you have to actually have people who are capable.
It
and
is,
you
true.
Know what? Not everybody is.
And that's okay.
It's absolutely okay. It is absolutely okay. As long as everybody understands that.
No,
so that'd be the question.
I heard, in fact, I had this one lieutenant, and I remember him. You know, when it came to doing administrative stuff, he was a dud. Terrible administrator. But when we got into the field, this guy was on his game, and he knew it. He knew what to do. He knew what was going on, and he was a really good lieutenant. I really enjoyed working with him. Just because, but you know, we go back into garrison, and he's just terrible at administration. But you know, it goes what you say. Not everybody's cut out to be an administrator. Some people are. Some people aren't. Some people are good
right.
with their hands and know what they're doing. Others are good with theory, you know. Others that are they're really good putting, you know, theory into practice and know what to do. And I think really prepper groups need that. I think patriot groups really need that. Militia groups need to have, like you said, competent leadership cadre, people that know what the hell they're doing. You may not like them, but they know what they're doing. By all means,
right, and it goes back to the respect thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's easier to respect somebody you like, but
right.
you have to respect somebody to respect somebody. Yeah, just
right.
I
hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
look. If you got somebody who has a persona that he's a weasel, and he's just out for himself. He's not going to get any respect for anything by anybody. And he's going to throw a fit, you know. So you have to, you know, your leaders have to be people that put the group first, person second.
Right, right.
And that's not always easy.
At some point, you have to at least be willing to periodically lead from behind. You know, I don't know how
I know what
describe that.
I know what you're saying. You have to be willing to let others take a shot at the leadership.
Right, right. And understand that, you know, no matter what, there's going to be somebody who's better at things than I am.
Absolutely.
And if I've got a half a brain as a leader, I'm gonna go, okay, where are my weak spots? Find me somebody who's stronger than that than I am so that weak spot doesn't become a vulnerability.
Absolutely. I agree.
Finally,
I agree 100%.
Get the strengths that, you know, like pieces in a puzzle. Put those strengths together.
I agree. And that's something that patriot leaders, prepper leaders, need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I get the idea. You know, when I was with the sheriff's office, they said, well, we're a quasi-military organization. I said, what the hell does that mean? Well... And what they were saying is, look, we're set up kind of like the military, you know, but we're not the military. We're not, you know, so, you know, I understand that. And to a point, prepper groups and patriot groups have to kind of follow that structure, the organizational structure, but you can tweak
mm-hmm.
it and tune it to the way it needs to be done. And you're going to need to do that in a critical event because not everybody, one, is going to make it to the rally point. Not everybody's going to make it to where they have to be. Some won't make it at all because they're dead and they're not breathing anymore. So you got to be able to be able to plug people in to those strengths that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you know. So anyway, well, my friend, I'm going to call it an evening because I know we got people that have to get up for work tomorrow. I'm not one of them, but I sure as hell don't want to keep everybody up when I don't have to. You have anything you want to say to the America?
I'll just reference back to what we were talking about. I think goes on Wednesday. What's in your pocket?
There you go.
And
what's in your
pocket? Start from there. I'm trying to make that my new mantra. What's in your pocket? What's the simple things that we can do every day that we do? You know, what is our routine? What do we use to do those routine tasks? And start with those things. Keep them close to you.
I think you'll like the first 20 minutes of tonight's show. It's called the Get Home Bag. And I think you'll like it.
I will go back and replay that. And it's funny that that's ironic because the last week or so that's what I've been focusing on is my get home bag and stripping it down. It's like, okay, I've got way more of this than I need, and I don't have any of that, and I should have that. So let's reconnoiter here and make things more efficient, more effective, so on and so forth. I'm just trying to do that kind of my whole thing. Hopefully it'll work.
There you go.
Hopefully I'm doing the right thing.
And before we go tonight, if you missed it, Foil Hat Soldier highly recommends last night's show, The Ladies of the Watch. I encourage you to listen to it. And so what's today? Today is Sunday, so I'll be back Wednesday night for the Roundtable Report. We thank you for listening. I'm John Jeffers, and my sidekick tonight has been the Foil Hat Soldier. Contact him in the chat room anytime. It is no problem at all. All right. So for my Pepper and Patriot friends, I say to you tonight and every night that we're on, be safe, be vigilant, and be alert. I'm John Jeffers. Thank you for the Contra Radio Network. Appreciate it for listening, and we'll see you Wednesday night. Night, Kev.
Good night.
Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy. They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine and More. Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy. They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine & More. Wine and More.